Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where network engineers to talk about life and real-world experiences in the networking industry. This week, the virtual whiteboard has been instantiated in downtown San Jose in Silicon Valley after a heavy week of nerdination in the after we've experienced the Applied OpenFlow Symposium on Wednesday and then Network Field Day 2 on Thursday and Friday. Not a single virtual thing happened all week. It was all real, practical, and in place. We had a bunch of people around. There are several videos up on Vimeo and things like that if you want to see it. But what we did was we got a bit of a round table with Ivan Pepelniak. How are you, Ivan?
Pretty good. Hey? I'm tired as hell, but excited about all the things we've seen.
I've seen your list of blog posts. You're going to be writing about it for, like, forever.
Yeah, it's like 25 blog posts already scheduled.
Yeah. It was a pretty good fun time, though.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the vendors really surprised me. They knew what they were doing.
It's good to see. Yeah. That they're getting on, like understanding what it is that we're talking about.
And they understand the problem, even though some of them try to explain the problem to us in 25 slides.
Yes, yes. That's a challenge. But, we'll talk more about that in a minute. So also with us today is Marko Milivojević.
Hi, it's actually Milivojević, and it's a pleasure to be on Packet Pushers after so long time. I wasn't part of OpenFlow Symposium or the Network Field Day 2 for a good reason. I was doing what I do.
You were making money.
I was making money, yes. But it's a great pleasure to be here, and I believe my purpose today here is to ask stupid questions.
Yeah, and we'll give you stupid answers.
There are no stupid questions, but we can't guarantee the quality of our answers.
That's too bad, right. And also with us today is Rob
Markovic.
Thank you.
So, this is like three-quarters Balkans and a guy from UK.
Well, technically speaking, from Australia, but yeah, I mean, we have...
And technically speaking, I'm not in Balkans.
Let's kick off the first topic today. Let's talk a little bit about the OpenFlow Symposium that we attended this week. Now, for those of you who haven't been listening to previous episodes and maybe have dropped in on this one, is Packet Pushers teamed up with Tech Field Day to sort of... take up a topic which is close to my heart, which is OpenFlow. And I see OpenFlow as having a big potential future with networking, but what I wanted to do is look at how OpenFlow is going to affect us at a practical level. So instead of saying OpenFlow is this great thing, let's get all the vendors together in a room and listen to what they've got to say. So I reached out to the people that we know from the events and said, would you be interested in joining along? And we ended up having people there from Big Switch, Juniper, Cisco, Brocade, and NEC. And all of those big vendor companies came together to talk about how they're actually delivering OpenFlow or planning to, or what their strategies look like, or how they see the futures of OpenFlow. So the idea behind the symposium was to try and scratch away at what the real practical eventualities of what OpenFlow might be. Now, I'll happily admit that OpenFlow is not the great thing today, but I think that it within 2 to 3 years we'll start to see some really exciting things come out of it, and in the longer term it's possibly the greatest, certainly shows potential to be the greatest change in networking that we've seen in probably 15 years. The road may be rocky and it may actually well stumble, but that's what we're here to do, is to talk nerdy about things in networking, and that's the topic of it. We also had at the symposium some talks from Igor Gashinsky of Yahoo and Ed Crabb of Google talking about what they're actually using to do it about. I mean, Ivan, you were there. What do you think about OpenFlow after seeing the event?
Well, you know, it's still the same thing as it was before. It's actually a simple tool to download forwarding or classifying entries into your forwarding or classifying table. Yep. It's amazing that most of the people get it. So we are past the hype stage, where it will change the speed of light and allow flat earth and unicorns to live happily without virgins and all that.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. One of the things that I thought was interesting was that we had, you know, the five bigger vendors. So Big Switch is a startup. They're manufacturing a controller, in VC mode, producing a controller. The first of the well-known controllers, I suspect, will be from Big Switch.
NEC already has their controller. It's up and running in production networks, so NEC was actually the first one deploying an OpenFlow controller in production networks.
Hmm. And we saw a demo of that.
Yeah.
And it's when you see that demo, you could just go, my. I saw it at Las Vegas, at Interop in Las Vegas, and it just blew me away with how interesting it was.
So yeah, it is interesting. I mean, they will have a lot of scalability work to do. Hmm. that they have hit a number of obstacles. They admitted that during the Tech Field Day presentation.
Yep.
It was like, you know what, when we finished at Stanford, whatever it was, our firmware was release 58 or something.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of issues. They learned a lot. They have all the right answers.
Yes.
They seem to know what they're doing.
But importantly, they actually have a hosting company as a reference site who's willing to go public, who are actually using OpenFlow and their OpenFlow-enabled switches. So NEC is different in that not only are they shifting the software that is a controller, they're also selling the hardware, that is the programmable flow switches that NEC makes.
Absolutely.
I have two stupid questions to ask right now.
No stupid questions.
No, I know. But one is the very nature of the OpenFlow. I get it, the control-based networking, downloading the flows to the switches. My first question is, this sounds very, very familiar, I've heard it before.
It is.
I remember when I was first being exposed to the MPLS that in some of the interesting books that I read, maybe the author is somewhere nearby me, but...
you can buy them on Amazon.
You can, okay. There was this talk about MPLS traffic engineering and using traffic engineering tunnels that could be built using the offline computation tool. And don't get me wrong, but I believe that Cisco called it the tunnel builder or something like that. Maybe I'm forgetting the name. How is this? How is the OpenFlow different from that idea? Because fundamentally, it's the same concept at some level.
It's not.
Okay.
One thing that they got right, which is they are not just addressing one bit of the puzzle, which is building the tunnels. They are also addressing the second bit of the puzzle. How do you get the traffic into those tunnels? That's, as you know, one of the major problems of MPLS traffic engineering. So even if you build dynamic tunnels that interact with OSPF or ISIS, then at least the routing protocol knows how to use that as the next hop. If you build static tunnels, then the ingress router has no idea how to use that tunnel because someone else built that.
Correct.
Think about OpenFlow as being a mechanism that allows you to install forwarding entries, PBR entries, and access lists into the router.
All in one go.
Well, all using the same protocol.
Okay.
Now take that a step further. You can also have protocol entries that munge the frame. So you could receive a frame.
Oh, and NAT.
Mm-hmm.
You could rewrite the header.
Yeah.
It's not NAT, as such, as we understand it. You can actually have a command that says, if I see something that matches this criteria, rewrite it to do this. You can write
So you can basically control the QoS signaling on the packets as well.
OpenFlow 1.1, you can set DSCP if you wish.
Right.
You can set the P bits in the 1P.
Mm-hmm.
You can add VLAN, you can strip VLAN, you can add MPLS tag, you can strip MPLS tag, you can set source or destination IP address, which gives you either load balancing or NAT. You can, I think, set the port number, not sure about that.
You can rewrite port numbers. You can mount anything basically in an Ethernet header or the IP header.
Yeah, or you can change the Ethernet source or destination address and you can decrement TTL.
That's actually pretty cool.
And count it.
That leads me to my next question, and that is, I believe that NEC has a remarkable product. I haven't seen it myself, and if you two guys are impressed by it, that works for me. However, my question there is, NEC has hardware, as Greg, you mentioned yourself, and they have a software. What happens if I want a vendor mix in my network?
How will
that work?
That's the beauty of OpenFlow.
On paper or in reality?
On paper.
Okay.
Everything's on paper so far. So
well, actually...
While NEC has a shipping product and will soon have some, I used the analogy, in 1996 when OSPF first arrived, nobody's OSPF implementations interoperated.
There was at least Proteon, not well.
No, and there was Cisco, there was Wellfleet, there was DEC, you know, there was not... And it took 5 years before they actually interoperated correctly and reliably. But then again, of course, OSPF didn't have areas. It took years for inter-area stuff to creep in and various other things to sort of get mainstream acceptance. I mean, it was always designed in, but a lot of them just didn't implement it.
Oh, that's a different story.
Yeah, so you can't sort of send inter-area routes when a one router doesn't only has area zero implemented, right?
Yeah, so it's that's a bit that, of a problem. Okay. So then well, you see, I've always been working with proper networking gear, so I work using some of those other companies.
I always assumed that you worked with Cisco.
Yes.
Oh, okay. So that's proper.
Okay.
Yeah, well, it was a great networking company, and then it diversified into cameras and all that stuff.
Oh, you mean they flipped?
Yeah, and they flipped. Yep. Luckily, that's gone now.
Nice play on words.
OpenFlow sort of at that stage. That while there's stuff there today, there's no way you can sit there and say, or no practical way, in my opinion, that you could say, let's go into implementation and make it live. We're a long way ahead of that. And what I wanted to do as a network architect, and somebody who looks 5 years into the future, who looks and attempt to set policy or strategy or concepts and say, what should I be spending my time researching? What should I be tracking? Should I be tracking, you know, the second topic we're going to talk about today is the VXLAN protocol and some of the political implications of that. Should I be tracking VXLAN, or should I be tracking OpenFlow, or should I be looking at, you know, Cisco's Nexo 1000V as an alternative way to do both of these, or is it the tool? So, and then should I be buying something like the Cisco switch protocol, switch software, or should I be using a different virtualization hypervisor which supports different protocols and maybe has me different choices? So, the process of researching these drives strategy decisions in the longer term. That's my purpose of talking about OpenFlow. It's not to say it's ready to go. It's more about tracking this over time so that we're aware of what it is and what it offers when it comes.
Well, to be honest, NEC had both Brocade and IBM switches in their lab, and they were using really a three-vendor network. But as Greg said, it's not a given. They will do a lot of integration testing. You will go back to the good old days of having hardware compatibility lists. It is at the stage of fiber channel, let's put it this way.
Yeah, but I mean, hardware compatibility.
If it hasn't been specifically allowed, don't try to mix and match.
Yeah, for the time being. If you're going to go down this path in the early stages, you're going to limit your scope of risk by going down a single vendor implementation.
But there is this inherent danger that something bad is going to happen along the way. Like it had happened before. I mean, another technology comes to my mind, and it is long dead, I hope. ATM.
LAN emulation.
Not LAN emulation. I'm actually talking about relatively more fundamental thing like PNNI, where you had different vendors that they were supposed to implement the same routing protocol, but the real interoperability between different PNNI implementations never really happened.
There's a fundamental problem inherent to anyone who tries to do large-scale per flow state throughout the network. It does not scale.
And so and how does OpenFlow then scale? Because it attempts to do the exact same thing.
No. OpenFlow gives you miles of rope to hang yourself. So it's not just yards or meters, it's miles. That's what surprised me. All these people we were speaking with during the last 3 days actually knew what they were talking about.
But you would expect that from vendors, but you know we can get all cynical here. But
yeah,
what was surprising was that they all knew what they were talking about, and they were happy to say this is where OpenFlow is weak, this is where the challenges are that we think we can answer, and I guess probably this spins around to a point. For example, Juniper is very strong on OpenFlow, announcing OpenFlow support in the Junos SDK for 12.3 of Junos, so they will be able to accept. Their devices will happily accept OpenFlow programming.
Oh, that one is great. You know what Junos is doing? They're using OpenFlow as a configuration mechanism. So you can install, what's the word? Ephemeral,
yeah, or transient state.
Static routes.
Mm-hmm.
And they get through OpenFlow, and they get redistributed into the regular routing protocols. So, for example, as you move virtual machines across your core, the edge routers could actually install static host routes pointing to those virtual machines.
And solving the problem, for example, of VM mobility in layer 3 networks instead of having a flat earth society.
Exactly.
That's pretty cool.
They could combine OpenFlow with traffic engineering. So someone requests a soft PVC, or a soft LSP, actually, that gets built either by configuring a traffic engineering tunnel or by a a third party installing static labels into all the switches, like you can do on Cisco or Juniper. And then with OpenFlow, you install actually PBR entries.
That is actually cool because I think it leverages the power of what OpenFlow can do
exactly.
Without requesting a whole redesign of the existing hardware. It's just a software modification using it as a configuration.
So that's one that use is case. Actually now, pretty consider cool. Consider a data center like, say, somebody at Yahoo or Google who've got massive scale, and they have an application that is dynamically run at a given time of day. So, for example, imagine you're Google and you have a rack of... I'm just hypothesizing here, right? Just making stuff up. But you've got a rack of servers, and during the day they run as mail routers. But at night they run as analytics engines, and they do a whole bunch of running report stuff. So what they do, theoretically, is pop the whole stack at a given time. It reboots into a new image, and you want a new traffic profile on your switches, right? All of a sudden you want to reprogram those switches to have a completely different configuration. Not just VLANs, but QoS profiles, routing engines, attaching to different iSCSI LUNs or wherever they get their storage from. And so you can use OpenFlow to just program the switch like this and then say, actually, that's a change. And as part of the script that repurposes those machines, re-images them, boots them to a new image and all that, it just pops the whole switch as well. Now, that's using ephemeral state at volume, but in a tightly controlled, rigidly bound system, that can work. Instead of a loosely coupled system like what Ivan's describing, which is saying we'll just implement OpenFlow at the edge of the network and then divert into an MPLS core with proven state and scalability and existing today, by the way, so don't have to change what your core looks like, so minimal risk, and then take the data center concept where you actually manage the state, whether it's ephemeral or not, on a permanent basis. It means that you've got and this is what I think means OpenFlow will get over the adoption hump, is that it's got a use case at scale where it can start, and then later on, it's going to be used, and then we have this tightly coupled case, right, like this, then because it's something for everybody, it's likely to get over. It's a multi-purpose. So BGP's greatest success was able to work at scale in the internet, and then we were able to adapt that to be used in the enterprise. And then we were able to adapt that for use in all these different functions as an enabler to drive MPLS. It becomes a platform. And OpenFlow, conceptually, as I see it, the way that BGP is, becomes a platform on which to enable other functions. So you can have controllers. So what will happen is, so for example, Big Switch is developing a controller which is, they haven't announced it yet, and I haven't had a detailed briefing.
They were talking about it, so you can talk about
it. Yeah, but they're more focused as an enterprise.
Okay, purpose, so, you know? Greg, the way that that was explained to me is they allow physical switches to be partitioned, mm-hmm. and then you can, in a multi-tenant environment, assign different ports on different switches to a tenant, be it virtual ports in Open vSwitch or physical ports on physical equipment, and they would use OpenFlow to install the forwarding entries so that that appears as a single switch or network. Okay. Of course, my first problem was the state in the core, and they are aware of that, and they're saying, well, you know, we work with what we have as the core. So Open vSwitch can run IP tunnels, so we can use that. Some people are smart enough to run MPLS, so we can use that. And some people are really objecting to anything, particularly MPLS, for no good reason.
Other than not understanding how it works.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And in that case, we just have to work with what we have, which is managing MAC addresses to establish actually tunnels across the layer 2 network.
Static paths. MAC routing.
No, here's one thing that... Okay. In this particular case,
my immediate response was, well, guys, you're reinventing the wheel. You know there is something called VPLS and MPLS VPN, right? And they go like, yes, that's true. And sort of didn't want to go any further trying to persuade me, which I really appreciate, because 2 hours later it clicked with their controller and their CLI and GUI. You can program your switch as a tenant.
So you can log in.
You configure your own switch. Wherever now imagine being able to configure your own VRFs in an MPLS VPN environment. You have a CLI that can log into all those PE routers and configures whatever you want to configure in your VRFs.
Okay, can I ask the question right now that has been kind of brewing in my mind for the past 5 minutes. And that is, why would I want to do it? In a multi-tenant environment, if I am a hosting operator, or the owner, the operator of the data center...
Think Amazon VPC.
Okay. I'm thinking Amazon VPC, but Amazon VPC is one. How many of these actually exist in the world? How much dynamic change do we actually have in small, medium, and relatively large data centers? Not massively scalable like the Amazon VPC. How big dynamic environment do we have that we actually need these features? And how often do tenants actually need to modify the VRF configurations on their own?
What you're asking there is almost an automation question. Tenants don't want to configure their own equipment. They want a graphical interface.
That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, in many, many cases, in many cases, you have tenant who wants a server that is able to connect to the rest of the world.
But now you've got a data center with 1,000 customers.
Yes.
So on any given day, let's say 1% of them are changing something, that's 10 changes.
But they're changing something on their servers. They don't require changes on the network.
No. You have to stop thinking about traditional hosting companies.
Okay.
Where you got your Linux host and you were done.
So what do I have to think about?
Netflix. Netflix is deploying massive number of virtual machines at Amazon for actually their control plane, their subscriber management.
Right.
And they have all sorts of networking requirements. So I have the database server. I have the app server, I have the authentication server, I have this server, I have that server. So they have like probably 5 security zones, all deployed at Amazon. And they have to configure those things with packet filters or firewalls. And you would want those things to be in different subnets, because if they're not in different subnets, you have actually problem writing packet filters. So you need... the ability, you have to give the tenants the ability to go out and deploy a full blown network on the virtual infrastructure.
Okay, let me
and they want to be able to deploy that in seconds.
Well, you're going back to the example of Amazon.
Let me give you an alternative example. Imagine you've got 1,000 physical servers in a data center. Each one of those 1,000 virtual servers is running a hypervisor, and on each one of those there's 20 virtual servers. So you've got 20,000 virtual machines. Let's say that those 20,000 machines are broken up into pieces, and there's each one connects to a vSwitch, and those machines dynamically migrate around that environment. So you don't know where the switch port is for that. So a given customer might be using 50 servers inside of that environment, and you want to log into that customer's switch. So there are virtual ports on virtual switches. Those servers would be connected to physical ports on physical switches.
And firewalls.
And if you're using the big switch approach, which is to virtualize the network, you can log into something and it just presents you those 50 virtual ports, those 20 physical ports that they're connected to, and the parts of the firewall configuration, all the way up from your Open vSwitch to your Cisco network core to your Juniper MX80 on the edge. You see them all as my network.
Conf-T.
Abstracted. Conf-T. And you can literally go... and there's some sort of syntax which allows you to log in. I've seen this in the demo at Interop. They had an interoperability lab, and you could actually log in, and you could log in, and you could see your Juniper switch Ethernet port on their router. You could see the switch port on the Blade, IBM Blade. You could see the ProCurve port on the thing. And that was all you saw, was just those interfaces, those sub-interfaces, the VLAN sub-interface, or the software interface, or the vSwitch interface.
All the ones related to your account.
Your account.
That's the thing that I missed in the initial talk, is that... they have the ability to control other equipment other than just the virtual equipment at the edge. That's the kitchen. I'm beginning to see it. I believe that I went through the same motions as you did in that presentation.
Right. So now let's say you've now got a controller that's punching OpenFlow data in and out of switches. So what Big Switch is doing is saying the controller can be used to create virtualized configuration models. But if I've got all the configuration of my devices in that controller, I can now actually add a software program to it that does ISIS routing through the network, can't I? And I could use ISIS as a way of loading route tables. or I might want to use one of these new routing algorithms that we've never bothered to use in the last 20 years. You know, all those research papers that talk about routing protocols other than ISIS, whatever they are. There's dozens of them. We've never implemented them because the vendors were never going to change their code. But what if I just said, I actually want to have an algorithm that routes my frames via some mathematical thing.
Oh.
Or maybe you would
GRP, actually... Greg's routing protocol?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so I want to use Greg's routing protocol.
Just imagine that in a dense topology, because you're using a controller to program the forwarding tables, there are no loops. So you can get rid of spanning tree.
Now, take all the data back, hand it into a Hadoop cluster, do a big data set analysis, and you can actually recalculate optimal paths through the network dynamically on the fly and be continually reprogramming that in a multipath environment.
Balancing the flows as you go.
That's very cool.
That's very cool.
Right?
You know what you remind me of right now? I get it. It's good. But it's the same thing. You see, I've been in this industry for a long time.
So have we.
No, I know, but you see, my roots, I began as a Linux sysadmin, and my pitch for Linux when I started doing it was, if you need anything, you can always program it yourself because you have a source code. How many times did it actually happen?
So the answer is, we probably will come down to five vendors, right? There will be a handful of controllers in the same way that we have control planes today, right? So today the only control planes we have. So my criticism of today's networking is that we have these routing protocols, 50-year-old routing protocols, 30-year-old. I mean, they've got hairy armpits, they're so old, right? So we have OSPF, we have ISIS, and BGP, and they're loosely coupled examples of, you know, where this guy tells the next guy some data, and then each one computes, right? So it's sort of like, it's partly a distributed computing problem, but it's a distributed computing problem that's loosely coupled, and it's prone to error. It's inherently the feedback loops between the different part of the system.
Well, it's called officially eventual consistency.
Yes.
That's the word I learned.
Now, for the last 25 years, eventual consistency, or eventually there'll be no loops, or would drop a few frames, a few packets has been acceptable. But in the new era, not so. So how do we solve those problems going forward? The answer is, the only viable answer. We've had several attempts at OpenFlow, by the way, over the years. There's been different...
But I believe that ultimately we didn't have enough computing power to implement it properly up to now.
We've also not had a problem to solve like we have today. So virtualization has brought around a new...
Virtualization has increased the problem by 1.5 orders of magnitude.
Complexity has increased, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Plus, you know, in the good old days... Server admins were configuring one interface with one IP address, and today server admins are configuring like six interfaces because the software we all love, like vSwitch, needs at least six uplink interfaces before it stops complaining that you don't have enough.
That's right, and then you need your storage interfaces.
Yeah.
And you probably need...
And not only that, so those guys are configuring... like six interfaces, and they're running their own switch inside, and they have like 20 plus servers connected to that switch using different VLANs. So that's increasing the complexity, not by an order of magnitude, because they have 20 things back there. It increases the whole thing exponentially.
Yep.
Because now you have to interoperate with those guys. And you know what the worst part of it is? That part of things sitting in the hypervisor, passing frames back and forth, is not talking to anyone. It's not communicating with anyone, and everyone else in the industry is running around in circles trying to figure out what that little guy is thinking. Because he's so dumb, he can't tell anyone what he's thinking.
Yes.
So isn't that the problem, again, that you brought up earlier on, that it is the application problem? Shouldn't that little guy be fixed?
Well, there's two things here. One's the centralized in a controller. And let's assume that the controller challenge can be solved, which I tend broadly to the belief that over time it will be solved. There's plenty of weaknesses with a controller-based design. We saw that in wireless LAN networks, right?
As in what happens when a controller fails?
Yes. There are...
Well, actually, NEC has already solved what? They have high availability implementation. Well, the first thing to remember is... if the controller fails, the switch's forwarding tables don't change. As long as there is no change in the network can run brainless until there is a change.
But that's equivalent of the non-stop forwarding.
Exactly.
Forwarding. But that does have issues because eventually you will have stale information.
Exactly.
Okay, so there are several different approaches to that.
Before there is a topology change.
Okay, so there's three possible approaches to the controller problem. One is active standby, HA. We know all about that, right? We do that in firewalls and load balance and all sorts of things today. So you have an active, you have a standby.
You can have that.
You can have what's called a DHT, or distributed hierarchical tree of controllers, right? Which is you can have a master controller, which then delegates sub-functions to other controllers, which delegates sub-functions to other controllers.
More peer-to-peer.
Distributed hierarchy, you can. So this is one way, which is to say this is the master who has a complete image, delegates it to a sub-one to delegate. So imagine a controller in every switch. So the controller in every switch idea has some secondary impacts because it means that you could actually have a open flow controller in the switch blade, which is now able to handle microflow management. So you can actually manage high volumes of ephemeral state. So you delegate a set of rules from the master controller to a controller in switch or in router, and it can then communicate flows into and out of the flow table at significantly larger volumes than an out-of-band process could. Now, there's some interesting ideas there. That's not going to come for years, because that's just...
And it does also have the challenges, because then you have the whole idea of networking the controllers themselves.
Okay.
We are back to distributed processing, like we had before. So it's a full circle.
It's a full circle. We're going back
to...
One of
the things that Yahoo was talking about at the symposium, and this is the one I found most fascinating, was he said there's also the third option is distributed computing. So in the same way that we run a MapReduce cluster or a Hadoop cluster, where they all process them in, and then they communicate backwards and forwards so that they all share the same data. So that is a well-known, well-understood...
Greg, I have to interrupt you right there. That assumes that the controllers can communicate to each other.
No. You see, that's the idea. They don't.
Okay.
They insert information into the common database.
Yeah, but they cannot insert data in the common database if they are the ones that need to program
You might not deploy a distributed computing solution into a service provider WAN. You might find a DHT controller.
I'm just saying, imagine three switches sitting on this table in front of us.
Yeah.
But we interconnect them with wires. The only way they can be programmed is from a controller. And you have two controllers that have to communicate over those two switches. So unless you have out-of-band communication...
Between the controllers. Absolutely, you have to have.
Okay, so that brings us back to, again, the problem of networking the controllers.
Actually, what this brings us back to is the good old frame relay world, where we needed out-of-band network to manage the switches.
And how do we configure the out-of-band network?
By hand.
Okay.
Well, maybe not. If your controller has sufficient intelligence...
So something is opening a new set of challenges for OpenFlow 10 years down the road.
No, we are back to... No, even today...
We already invented that wheel.
Yeah, we are back to out-of-band management.
We only do in-band management.
You can do in-band. You can split the brain of the switch. You can say only these things will be done through OpenFlow, and the other packet forwarding will be done using the regular switching mechanism.
But then we are back into the times when we had deconverged networks, and the whole process in the past 15, 20 years in networking was converging the networks into one converged network.
What exactly
have we accomplished? Does it mean that past 20 years have been a massive failure?
You're virtualizing that interaction. So you'll have a converged network with virtualized slices of in-band, out-of-band, management.
Well, you see, even today, people sometimes deploy out-of-band management on their switches. So, if you already have that, you're fine. Sometimes people will use VLAN 1. That's also fine. Well, then, you have to be careful and configure the whole thing in split brain, so that VLAN 1 cannot be touched by the OpenFlow controllers. You always have communication on VLAN 1.
That's how MPLS works. There's an out-of-band network in the global routing table.
Well, no.
No.
That's how MPLS-TP will work once they get all the standards ready.
Yeah. But, I mean, conceptually, we carry all the data inside the MPLS plane, but all the control traffic goes around in,
well, actually,
in the global routing table.
That was sort of how MPLS worked over ATM. VLAN 1 we have in OpenFlow networks today is exactly the same thing as that VC, what, 16 or 22?
You could choose it, the one that you use to exchange, to run LDP over to control all the other VPs.
Yes,
that's right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Control Been VC, there, right? Seen that. We know how that works.
Yeah.
So
how it, that didn't
do
work.
We sort of, I mean, the it answer worked. Is all these things are yet to be resolved.
No, but it's good. This is how I see this conversation that you're having right now. Mm. I'm a skeptical here. I'm asking questions.
I was a week ago.
No, I'm seeing the power, but I also see a lot of challenges. And one thing that I keep repeating, and I have been repeating for the past couple of years, is that I don't think that, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think that we are able at this point in time to invent a truly new solution. Everything that we talked about right now is going back.
It's incremental.
It's going back. There is no revolution in networking.
Well, okay. Let's say this has the potential to be the Linux of networking. Linux is nothing new. Linux is an operating system which is actually, sorry Linux, a clone of another operating system that was invented 40 years ago.
Agreed.
But because it's widely available,
it revolutionized the way we approach things.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Juniper's all in. Startups are being funded around the space. We've got Nocera. We've got
Big Switch.
We've got four or five others. We've got like a whole cadre of university grads at Stanford and all of the big American universities and overseas.
Solving the load balancing over WAN with OpenFlow.
Yeah.
That scales really
They're
well.
All using Java to write OpenFlow controllers so that when they leave, they can join.
Cool.
You know, or whatever. What I'm saying is there's people here investing significant amounts of effort. Furthermore, the people who wrote the protocols are somewhat heroes of the movement. So people like Nick McCown, Scott Schenker, Martin Casado are all well known as previously inventing protocols that we use today. Let's not pretend that they didn't invent another 25 along the way that didn't get anywhere, but let's pretend that they've got some practical experience in, you know, as RFC 1925 says, it's not what you put into a protocol that matters, it's what you take out, right? So let's not pretend that it's going to just happen today. But Brocade is attacking OpenFlow as a service provider topic. Not an enterprise product, not as a virtualization. They see OpenFlow, as I understand their marketplace, as a service provider issue. Ericsson has produced some research. We didn't come to the symposium.
I just have this bad feeling.
They are producing OpenFlow.
I heard the word Ericsson.
They are producing a demonstration of an IP MPLS to OpenFlow interoperation where they actually signal backwards and forwards to an IP MPLS. So you can create this.
Also, they mastered the art of actually knowing what IP does?
They haven't. Well, who knows? They demonstrated it. You've got NEC shipping a product in the enterprise data center today and for hosting and data center. So it's there. You've got Cisco sitting on the wings, not committed one way or the other. There's a fair chance they've got something. We know that 2 or 3 years ago, Cisco had demonstrated code and a 6500 that would take OpenFlow, and then it disappeared from view. So we don't know what Cisco's going to do in the future. We also know that we've got Brocade, Juniper, Cisco, NEC.
We don't have Cisco. They're
sitting and looking what will happen. I think they have announced OpenFlow support for Nexus 3000.
That's right, yes. But the Nexus 3000 is not their core product. So it's not a commitment.
Seems like a bridge.
It's
well, you know, the trick is that thing uses merchant silicon.
Mm-hmm.
And there is already an OpenFlow implementation for that merchant silicon.
The silicon itself supports OpenFlow because it's designed in at the time.
So it was mostly a side effect that Cisco supports it, a commitment.
It didn't take anything to actually turn it on, but some small changes to the code. Now, will they do it into the 7000 and the 5000? We think they will. What about the controller side? Are they going to develop their own controller? You know, what's their intention? Are they going to
If I would be Cisco, I would turn Nexus OS into an OpenFlow controller. Because it's just changing the interface between the control plane and data plane and you're done.
That would mean doing a sensible thing, and unfortunately Cisco lately...
Well, they're doing some great things.
And they're doing some not-so-great things, like any big company. Let's move on. We've been talking a lot about virtualization. We've been talking a lot about how OpenFlow changes. Let's compare that against a protocol that we've been having discussions on all week, because the OpenFlow discussion and how it handles virtualization leads into a discussion of the VXLAN protocol. We met with Force 10 yesterday during Network Field Day. We talked with Brocade about their VXLAN plans. And in a previous podcast, we talked about where I spoke to Ken Duda, who was the co-author on both the VXLAN and the NVGRE standards for these similar types of things, where one of the challenges around VXLAN is to get hardware support so that we can crack the tunnels open. Just to set the scheme, for those of you who don't know, VXLAN is a tunneling protocol that VMware has cooperated with Cisco, Arista, and a handful of others. I think Citrix is involved.
Red Hat.
And Red Hat. And Citrix.
So everyone.
A significant portion, excepting, you know...
New Gang of Four.
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah.
They got together to announce a protocol which allows for tunneling of data from virtual machine to virtual machine. The protocol itself encapsulates packets in a sort of a GRE-type tunnel, which is using UDP, not TCP, and then it uses a multicast backbone to replicate the broadcasts and Ethernet broadcasts and Ethernet multicasts. So the Ethernet packets, as they come out of the vSwitch, goes into an IP frame, which is UDP, and then gets sent off to the destination for unicast traffic in the normal method, as you might expect. Tunnels are created by the vSwitches, and then multicast and broadcast are then Ethernet multicast and broadcast are then use a multicast tree to be replicated across. So therefore, things you need to know.
And
about
they're multi-point GRE tunnels, I suppose. For multicast and broadcast replication.
Actually, VXLAN is a multi-point tunnel.
Okay.
It's not GRE; it's UDP, and the only reason is load balancing.
Okay.
So load balancing at the Ethernet level.
No. Load balancing across the core.
Across the core. So for things like Ether channels, uses UDP so that you uses different source ports for different parts so that you can load balance as you go across the Ether channels.
Yeah, right.
But if you're using layer 3 links for load balancing, it'll load balance between layer 3 links as well, equally as well as equal
layer 2. Wherever you have equal cost multipathing, you can use the 5 tuple to load balance.
Yeah.
And that's what they're using here. So they actually hash the original packet into the source UDP port. So that gives them enough entropy so that the load balancing is good.
Yeah. The point to remember here is that ECMP occurs at two levels in core network designs. Ethernet via things like LACP and chassis aggregation, so multi-chassis.
Yeah, port channels.
Port channels, but also at layer 3. So if you build a pure layer 3 backbone, you have enough entropy to do equal cost multipath routing at layer 3 as well as at layer 2. So these, you know, your backbone design choices suddenly scale up into something at a several levels. Now, the second advantage of VXLAN, of course, is because VMware invented it, their vCenter console, their management platform, drives it. So the configuration of it comes out of vCenter, right?
It's a port group.
The challenges around VXLAN is that once we put traffic in a tunnel, it's invisible to the network. We can't QoS what's inside it. We can't expose it to firewalls because it's...
VXLAN firewall traffic. Is actually not that much of a problem because firewall is... usually between two subnets, and it was traditionally between two VLANs. Yeah. So it's well understood that for a firewall to operate, you have to push the traffic somewhere, do whatever magic on it, and push it back into the core. IDS is a problem, because it's passive and sitting in the middle.
I think it also opens the trouble for firewalls, because you could have, in two data centers, firewalls that sit in front of them.
Okay, let's be very clear. 5 microseconds after VMware announced VXLAN, people were starting to say this is a great layer 2 data center interconnect solution.
So the
let's
just hold there. VXLAN is explicitly not for vMotion between data centers. So
not
people who are listening, it doesn't do it, and you shouldn't design it. And if you're dumb enough to, go home and leave the industry.
It's part of the name, VXLAN.
You have a firewall that sits in front of your data center, and you want to interconnect. It's not for vMotion. You want to have two machines that appear to be on the same subnet that are actually sitting in two remote data centers.
Wrong. That's not how you use VXLAN.
Okay.
It's not a LAN stretching mechanism.
What is it?
So you have VLANs. We know they don't scale because of whatever reasons, broadcast, unicast flooding, and so on.
Security.
And the number of VLANs. There's a very specific use case that is tied to large blocks of compute and networking resources like a VCE block. In that particular case, you run out of VLANs because that particular block uses components that don't support all 4,000 VLANs, or at least didn't in the initial incarnation. So that's where VCDNI comes in, the stupid MAC over MAC thing. Within that VCE block, very limited broadcast domain, it gives you more than a few hundred VLANs that you need to host your tenants. Yeah. And then you have to stop, because if you stretch your layer 2 beyond that, you just risk your data center.
Yeah.
So actually, you have to isolate layer 2 domains.
Yeah.
And if you want to stretch a virtual LAN between different layer 2 domains in each data center, you have to encapsulate Ethernet into IP. Which is the use case for VXLAN, and nothing more and nothing less.
Okay, so it cannot be used for data center interconnect,
no.
But again, my point can still be valid. Okay, I assume that you can use it for data layer 2 stretching, for VLAN stretching, and people will use it for that, like it or not.
And they should go into, I don't know, cloud industry?
Well, look, but we know that people do all sorts of weird things that were not envisioned by the designers or the protocols. But anyway, let's say, same data center, 2V blocks, you have layer 3 infrastructure in between. Your design calls that you want to protect this environment and you put the firewall.
Yeah, and you're talking so about now, how does it get out of the VXLAN when you want a firewall?
Exactly. Right? How does firewall, I mean, it does...
Today, the only equipment that can terminate a VXLAN subnet is the vSwitch. Well, absolutely, no, Nexus 1000V. So, if you want to get out of that LAN, you have to use a virtual machine-based layer 3 device.
So
layer 3, router, load balancer, firewall, whatever you wish, it has to be running in a virtual machine, sitting in a vSphere host that uses Nexus 1000 vSwitch, so that its VNIC, the virtual Ethernet interface, can be connected to the port group that is actually the representation of VXLAN virtual LAN.
So that's the way it is right
so
now.
So you cannot, in your design, you cannot use a hardware-based firewall to filter between two.
No,
not today.
No, not today.
Now, the vendors are talking about implementing hardware tunnel cracking. So they will take the tunnel, terminate it in hardware, and then munge it through some sort of process. So both Arista and Cisco are both working on that today. Now, If you're VMware, think about what that means. What VXLAN means for you. It effectively drives customers into using VMs on their virtualization platform to implement network functions. So as far as VMware is concerned, it says virtual firewalls with virtual network appliances, with virtual this and that, all inside of our ecosystem, and pretend that the network doesn't exist. And it all sits inside of vCenter. So as far as VMware is concerned, VXLAN reinforces their market dominance, locks you into their proprietary platform of vCenter administration, and drives you into buying more expensive vCenter tools to manage all of those resources and generates more revenue.
And for every virtual appliance that you have to deploy because this thing is not yet terminated on a physical box, you pay the vTax.
Yep.
So, all in all, a pretty good business plan.
Business plan for vCenter and not necessarily a great one for customers overall. So now let me talk about some use cases. So if you're just hosting a bunch of small machines in a virtual multi-tenant environment, so let's say you've got a data center infrastructure, let's go back to the 1,000 machines, 20 servers, and your customers are buying chunks of 50 servers, a bit of Exchange, a bit of SQL, a bit of SharePoint, actually Share Bloody Point, a bit of a web server for a bit of an internal, whatever it is, let's say you're managing a standard sort of enterprise platform, you've got 50 servers of rubbish in there, right?
Well, let's just say 10 to make it more interesting.
Sorry?
Let's just say 10, not 50.
10, okay. So you still need a firewall to make sure that so they can get in and out to the front. You might want a WAN acceleration solution to make it work reasonably fast because Microsoft protocols run like rubbish. You might want to implement some sort of load balancing because you've got an Exchange cluster at the back there that needs a bit of a load. And you maybe the SharePoint needs a bit of help along as well because it runs pretty crappy on its own, right? So let's just take those three examples. So what you would then instantiate is three virtual networking appliances inside the cluster. You've now got 10 servers So the only way to bring all of that together is inside of a VMware's vCenter platform. And then you would present that at some point upstream. Now the challenge here is, now imagine what happens when you want to start doing SSL termination so that you can inspect that for a security function. So let's say you want to bring up a software IDS function. So you add a software IDS system to that. It's still all inside of the VXLAN. So you're now using, 100 VLANs for all those machines, including transit VLANs between zones and all that sort of stuff. But the challenge comes when you're terminating a 2048-bit SSL key, and you can't do it in software because the performance drives the machines into the floor. You would have to allocate more than one virtual CPU. And once you have more than one virtual CPU, the VM can't be migrated. Right? No vMotion.
It can. Just fault tolerance is not available.
You sure can. You sure can. Yeah. But the CPU count is not relevant.
No. But you start running into challenges in the infrastructure.
You can run less VMs.
Yeah, the other problem is also with high availability, because larger chunk has to be free on the other vSphere host.
If you start allocating
for that machine
two
to be restarted on the other side.
It's not efficient, right? The trend of VMs going in larger size, eating up more resources, is harder to deal with overall.
Yes. So if you start creating a 4 vCPU, you've got to find another server to migrate to that's got 4 vCPUs spare. Not so easy to. So you have these secondary, and decoding the asymmetric handling of an SSL with a 2048-bit key is extraordinarily processor independent. Yeah. So the solution would scale for small situations, or handling IDS IPS traffic for a small site in software works fine. But in hardware, you could be dedicating an entire chassis to a gigabit of, like a Cisco's IDS 4400s. They have these monstrous Xeons, and they have 4 of them, and they can barely cope with, a couple of gigabits per second of traffic in the IDS system. So if you're talking about any sort of reasonably sized system, the virtual appliances don't scale at all well. Now, you could have an argument that you could throw effectively an infinite number. So this would be the argument of the other people, is to say, well, if one doesn't scale, have half a dozen, because it's still cheaper than buying a dedicated hardware appliance. My response to that is that you then get into complexity issues, where now you're suddenly managing 6 IDSs instead of 1. We have enough troubles today managing 1. Imagine having 6 IDS appliances. So what they're saying now is, well, let's move the IDS functions to the servers. So where the actual server is, you have virtual firewall at the server, then you have your IDS appliance that sits with it, and you have a VWAS right in front of the server. So every one of your 10 servers has its own firewall, WAS, and IDS engine. And so what comes out of there then is VXLAN between all of the other systems.
But it doesn't sound like something that would scale and that would be manageable at any level. But what my biggest concern is, how do you protect that infrastructure itself?
Yeah.
How can you identify the actual VXLAN traffic?
Well,
how do you protect the server from being attacked by a bogus VXLAN traffic?
The only thing you can do is you isolate that core from anything else. VXLAN as such has no protection. So the interfaces where you run VXLAN should be in a totally isolated part of the network. Separate VLANs, separate VRF, separate IP routing. Because the moment anyone can attach to that thing, you're toast.
That was exactly my point, and exactly why I raised the question of firewalls. This is the biggest issue I see with it.
Yeah, but you got to remember virtual. So the counter argument, if I can play devil's advocate, is virtual firewalls, virtual appliances.
For a change, because I was playing one. past hour.
I'm playing inverse devil's advocate. Then.
Double inverse.
Then you're dependent on the V bloody center to control all of those things, right? And so your V center becomes a point of weakness. So then you have to share your vCenter to your security people, your network people, your server people, and your VMware people, and that generally doesn't happen.
Right. Well, maybe not today, but think about it this way. So VMware has slowly evolved over the years. Traditionally now, we have management of, local data centers, maybe 2, right? So you have the capability of linking vCenters together. But think a little bit ahead. So maybe you have a global organization that has a global set of data centers, and you need to manage them all. How would you do that, right? You need a new paradigm on how vCenter is going to be designed and installed and managed. So if you have a single point of management, like your brain, and it's designed differently, which I'm sure is coming, you can see where this is going. You can have a global infrastructure management system for all of your stuff, including networking, security, VMs, and all kinds of stuff.
But that's more of a political/policy decision than it is a technical enforcement. My concerns about VXLAN as described here is more of a technical level, I need to have a separate network for it.
Yes, and yes. More importantly, so my fundamental challenge here is, we have, in data center environments today, the people who build the data center networks are already having hissy fits about using Spanning Tree. Spanning Tree is a beautifully simplistic protocol, and yet most data centers go around the world to get rid of it. VSS, VPC, MLAGs, you know, all of that stuff.
Well, you could argue against Spanning Tree and the efficiency, how yeah. Spanning Tree works and the speed it takes to converge, but it does what it's designed for bloody well.
Absolutely. But we still have people in data centers who would go to extreme lengths to take it out.
Yeah.
Because it creates a single failure domain is the biggest risk.
Not right? only that, but I heard all sorts of silly arguments, as in, we turn off Spanning Tree because it could cause problems. Yeah. It can cause loops for some reason.
What?
Yeah. Believe it or not, that's what I heard. Yeah. Is that, you know, we turn off, as a matter of policy, Spanning Tree in our networks because we want to avoid Spanning Tree loops.
I actually admire.
So if you don't have Spanning Tree, you don't have Spanning Tree loops.
That's exactly right.
That's a good one.
You're thinking about it all wrong, right? If I turn off Spanning Tree and somebody plugs a cable in and causes a loop, who's to blame? Me or the person who put the cable in?
Good point.
Right? So I would turn off Spanning Tree because I'm never the guy that gets blamed at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Self-preservation.
Right?
So that's a good one.
Okay, let's just get this in perspective. I'm a big fan of turning off Spanning Tree if I'm going to get blamed for it going wrong because some moron put a cable in back the front. Right? Let the moron who put the cable in be blamed. If we've got data centers where Spanning Tree is a problem, how the hell do we expect to implement multicast to make it work? If we've got a competency gap with running PIM in a data, you know, anywhere today, the adoption rate for multicast, and most people have struggled to learn multicast, God knows I do, then...
What is multicast?
Then are you seriously saying we're going to implement PIM bidirectional? It has to be bidirectional PIM. Can't just be, you know, sparse mode or something simple. It has to be bidirectional.
I think it can be sparse.
Well, it can be sparse mode. It most definitely could be source-specific multicast too. But then again, we are hitting exact problem that you are describing.
So, well,
and me being a CCI instructor, I know what people struggle with spanning with multicast. The only problem is that I always struggle with people struggling with multicast because multicast is one of those technologies that it's very, very difficult to break. And it takes 3 commands to enable.
Well, let's also look at it from another perspective. VXLAN will not be used in an enterprise data center in the next 3 milliseconds. The primary use case are cloud infrastructure providers.
Yes, that's right.
In the next 3 milliseconds, which are usually people who are also service providers.
Who need more than 4,096
VLANs.
And that is the only... So, if you're listening to the show, the only use case where VXLAN matters to you is if you need more than 4,096 VLANs in that part of your network where your VMware is.
Yes.
Otherwise, forget what your reseller is telling you, run away. Because it's a short-term fix to a short-term problem before something else comes down the pipe. And that's... The OpenFlow is one. There are other things we could see.
Well, stepping stone.
Greg, let's put it this way. We need to decouple virtual from physical. Because if we don't decouple, then the core network will never scale. You cannot keep the location of all virtual machines in your core network. It doesn't matter if these are MAC addresses, so you're doing bridging, or if these are host routes, so if someone would actually be smart enough to do layer 3 routing directly over the network core. In both cases, if you have to know where 200,000, Igor Yashinsky's case, I think he said like 2.5 million virtual machines are, that can never scale. So we need to decouple physical from the virtual. And the only way to do that is to transport things over IP.
I think this is the smartest thing that I have heard in networking said in past 10 years.
Thank you.
And here is the reason why.
Can I get this in writing, please?
Yes, you can.
Is it
pen? Yes, you can. And virtualization has been with us for years and years. The only times when we started talking about the matters of scale and how it actually causes problems in the networking is when we started blurring the world between virtual networking, virtual infrastructure, and the physical. Now, in good old days, we always had a physical network, and we had applications that were running there. Now, I think that the biggest problem is that with the advent of virtual network, virtualized servers, we are blurring that boundary between virtual infrastructure and the physical infrastructure that needs to enable that. We need to have virtual servers be an application on our network.
Perfect. That's exactly what I wanted to say. The only people that got it so far is Amazon, because they do exactly that. And that's why they scale as well as they scale.
And this is why they probably have the only virtual platform in the world that they are able to offer as a service, as an application. Everyone else is struggling with the exact same thing.
Well, Amazon's got some limitations, right? A, it's expensive, much more expensive than a private cloud. Secondly, Amazon doesn't allow any broadcasts or Ethernet broadcasts or Ethernet multicasts.
Of course not, because that doesn't scale.
It doesn't scale, and it's a security risk.
Well, it doesn't scale.
Yeah.
Because if you could implement that securely.
Sorry, when I say VXLAN, I mean operational security risk for them.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So if somebody writes a dumb script that spams out broadcasts everywhere, it'll take down everything in the nearby, in the same VLAN, right? So it's a security risk in terms of operational security, not as. So that's why they actually block that in the driver. So you can't generate Ethernet multicast or broadcast on an Amazon EC2 instance because they're just, the network driver underneath blocks it, drops it dead. That's how they solve the scalability issue and the security issues around it, right?
What they're doing here, and I think it's actually intelligence, and again, I'm going to address the listeners. If you are building cloud, do the same thing Amazon does, because they are actually forcing application developers to work around the limitations. They are saying, this is what you do, this is what we can do for you. If you don't like it, build your own. But if you like it, if you like the price, and obviously many people do like the price, write applications that work on our platform. Our platform will not be adapted to badly written applications.
Yeah. Public clouds are for poor people, people who can't afford to buy a proper computer.
Well, I disagree. I think Netflix is a major success story. We mentioned Netflix before. It's a major success story for Amazon.
Well, there are two types of people who benefit from public cloud. The poor people, obviously, mm-hmm. and the people that have huge variability in the load.
Yes. Because, but they're pretty niche use cases.
Well, they're pretty big use cases. Not the poor people. Well, both are pretty big use cases.
Yeah. So let's get, you know, that aside, you know, that's an interesting, you know. But what I also want to do is compare the OpenFlow approach, which also allows programming and control of virtual switches. So VMware could always make their virtual switch open to OpenFlow and external programmability. At the moment, VMware has taken the view that they own the switch and only they can control it. And they will not allow us in the networking industry to work with their switch. They have walked away and abandoned things like 802.1bg and 802.1br by doing this. VXLAN says we aren't going to get into trying to exchange data. So in the storage industry, probably because EMC owns VMware and forced it onto them, they've created API so that vCenter can talk to the storage and exchange data between the two. So I can poll the storage array with VASA and VAAI APIs and say, give me this data, give me this configuration data. Why not work with the networking industry to create one of those? Why doesn't vCenter reach out and say, I want this vSwitch to tell you this. Tell me what VLANs are configured here so that I can configure my vSwitch. Why not implement MPLS on a vSwitch and work with an integrated design that actually comes up with a working solution instead of... Now, these aren't small challenges, don't get me wrong, but why is VMware not thinking strategically? Why are they just pinch-hitting with another temporary solution, which is what VXLAN is? VXLAN solves the multi-tenant virtualization hosting problem for the next year while what? What's next? I don't know.
I think that there we are going into the... business cases, what VMware... I mean, I wouldn't want to say that VMware are stupid for not doing it. I'm sure that they do have...
Well, no, they're pretty smart, actually.
I remember when VMware started, when their first VM was free, I remember downloading it and playing...
It's still free.
Playing with it. No, but I'm talking about the very, very first one when they came out. When was it? In 99, 2000, 2001, maybe?
Yep.
An application that worked on your computer, that was always a server application. And, you know, being a network guy myself, we all know our opinion of server people is that they don't really understand networking. And Greg, I remember your diagram of how network people see server infrastructure and how server people see network infrastructure. I think that describes it. And this is the root cause of this problem, is that VMware, I believe that senior engineers there fundamentally don't get networking.
Well, you see, the way it was nicely explained to me, what actually to the server people is, you know how you feel when your customer calls you with a stupid problem, and you know it's a stupid problem, you see, you are our customer.
Yes.
So VMware is solving the immediate challenge, in my view. They're not strategically extending and saying, or if they are, we're not seeing any public...
That's what I was about to say. Maybe they are doing it, but we don't know about it.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of small steps being taken, and you need to build in small chunks to enable something bigger. And this is just one of those steps. So stay tuned.
Maybe. All right. That's it for the show this week. And thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. This show was recorded on October 29th in San Jose. So if you're listening in a few weeks' time and wondering why it's not quite so relevant, make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us this week. Thank you, Rob.
You're welcome.
What are you going to be doing this week?
I will be wrangling more V-blocks, and that's my life.
Huzzah. Marco, what are you going to be doing?
What I was doing last week, making money.
Ain't we all?
Teaching the class, I guess.
Sure. And Rob, tell us what your Twitter handle is and your blog.
I'm trying to avoid vlogging, but you can reach me on Twitter anytime at VRobM.
And Marco?
I am at IceMarcom, and my blog is where my company works, and it would be blog.ipexpert.com. I've been a little bit lazy in the past couple of months, but I promise to blog a little bit more in the future.
Yeah.
And Ivan?
Flying home, taking a rest. The kids have vacation next week, so we'll be at home probably.
Okay, and I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com or on the Twitters as at etherealmind and on plus.google.com as Greg Farrow. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Alternatively, you can check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net and leave comments on today's show or follow us on Twitter as at packetpushers. We'd love to hear your feedback. It really is important. And I look forward to seeing you in a few weeks' time. As remember that, too much networking
would never be enough.